Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. I don't know about you, but my phone feels like an extension of my brain a lot of the time. I can't commit to an appointment without checking my calendar. There are to-do lists and voice memos to make sure I don't lose an idea. And of course, there's Google there to instantaneously answer any question. Well, my next guest has taken this kind of behavior to an extreme. Jerry Michalski is a career tech analyst with a unique claim to fame, the world's largest published brain. It's called, of course, Jerry's Brain, and you can find it at jerrysbrain.com. Right now, Jerry's real biological brain is in our Woods Hole studio with me. Jerry, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to have the natural one installed.
And we're hoping that it stays that way. What prompted you to create, though, an online version of your brain?
It's funny. So I spent a dozen years as a tech industry analyst, kind of a trends analyst. I estimate that in that dozen years, I probably saw 4,000 startups come through and brief me. They wanted us to write about them. And I got lucky. One of those startups had a product called The Brain. And when I booked the meeting, you roll your eyes, and you're like, right, The Brain. Mm-hmm. And then they sat down and started to do the demo. The inventor opens his laptop. And the moment he starts showing me this thing, I'm like, oh, that's kind of how my brain sees things. Hmm. And I would not have expected on that day that 20 years later, I would still be using the product. And this December will be 20 years. And I would also not expect that the file that I'm curating now is the same file that I started 20 years ago.
Wow.
So imagine one concept map that has everything you've cared about, worth remembering for 20 years, that you've been improving, curating, like you move things around. You're always gardening a little bit in there.
I mean, as you've referred to, this is a file. It's kind of a database of thoughts and connections in your brain. It's not what a neuroscientist would maybe consider a brain. It's not
at all
thinking or computing or anything like that.
Nor does it have any internal intelligence, so it doesn't make any suggestions to me. It's sort of like Photoshop for ideas. It's a good tool for drawing or for putting things down in context and linking them to each other. Beyond that, it doesn't do very much.
I know for myself, I often use Google as kind of backup memory, right? Okay, so I talked to this person and I don't remember their full name, but I remember part of their name and where they worked or what they were working on, and it's enough to kind of Google and find that person. You've got that maybe more easily at your fingertips in Jerry's brain, but it seems like what this is really doing for you that the rest of the internet can't do is those connections that you specifically have made between the different ideas, between the different people.
Exactly. Because I have 20 years of context, I have articles that I find because I put them in a long time ago that don't have any Google juice, which means not too many people pointed to them, so they don't show up in Google searches anymore. The URLs may still be alive, but if you run a search today,
you won't
find it.
They just weren't popular enough to make it to the top of the list.
Exactly. And so we, sort of collectively, we've outsourced our memories to Google. We're like, oh, I'll just Google that. And I have friends who are A-list bloggers, so they used to blog to just remember stuff. And they would, when they Googled, their blog entry would show up so they could remember it.
It's in some way, a different version of what you're doing. How long, though, do you spend doing this every day?
It's open all the time as a utility. So I don't know exactly what slice of time it is. It's totally non-trivial, but it's not like half my day is spent doing this. One of the really big insights from using it for 20 years, and it didn't take 20 years to get to the insight, was that we are an amnesic civilization. We forget everything.
I'm right there with you.
And partly, I blame the copyright industries. TV, radio, magazines, newspapers, because whenever somebody invented a technology like cassette tapes that would allow us to store and maybe remix and reuse stuff, they darkened the sky with lawyers. And so technologies that let us curate media have been suppressed over years and years. So now I look around, and I've been covering software for a really long time, and everything is flow. Think of your Instagram, Pinterest, Tumblr, tweet, Snapchat, your email, everything is flow. And almost nothing is there to help you pull interesting things from the flow and create a context.
There's very little permanence to any of that. It's here
almost
one second
nothing.
And gone the next.
Exactly.
What about things that you maybe don't know in the moment are significant? Right? I mean, I'm thinking you could be, maybe you're traveling, you're in a new city, you're walking to your hotel, you happen to pass a drugstore, you don't really notice it consciously, but a few hours later you cut your finger, you realize you need a Band-Aid and go, oh, I passed a drugstore. Right. Do those things make it into Jerry's brain? Or are there things that, I mean, there's got to be a million real things in your real brain that never make it into the online version.
For sure. There's some kind of a mental threshold I have of, is this thing I'm looking at right now worth remembering? right? And if it's not, I don't want to clutter my brain with it. So I don't just willy-nilly throw stuff in just to do stuff. There actually, in 20 years, there's never been a moment where I thought, oh my gosh, I must put something in my brain today and I don't know what to put it. I've never hit that moment. Like when you have to blog and you don't know what to blog about, that just doesn't happen. So I do put in lots of things that later I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm so glad I put that in.
You've mentioned two phrases, one that we're an amnesic society, we're constantly forgetting things, and also that we've outsourced our memory to the internet. A study earlier this summer, a University of Texas Austin group published research showing that, in fact, our attention and our cognitive abilities go down if our cell phone is just in sight. It can be turned off face down, but if we can see it, our ability to focus and perform thought tasks goes down. So if you're constantly creating an online version of your brain, are you in some ways just embracing this outsourcing and kind of dumbing down and saying, I don't need to remember it in my real brain. I've got it over there.
I think that on the one hand, dinner conversations are now not, gosh, I don't know, honey, next. Now it's like, well, like Google it.
Let's Google it.
Find it out. And so
that's how we solve family arguments.
I have Alexa and a Google Home at home. So I call out and ask whatever, all sorts of different things. So I think that home conversations are getting richer and better because of a lot of these tools just being at hand, because you can be inquisitive and you can go learn if you're so inclined. To me, the story behind the story is the other thing I've been working on, which is sort of the consumerization of our universe. And I realized in the middle of the time, around the same time as the brain shows up, I realized I don't like the word consumer in the middle of all these briefings. And everybody uses it. It's absolutely a term of art in the business. And I'm like, why does this word bother me? So partly what's happened is we've been dumbed down by being treated as mere consumers for 50 to 100 years.
I'm talking with tech analyst Jerry Michalski about our somewhat tortured relationship, perhaps, with
Indeed.
Technology and our own brains. Let's do unpack some of that. I mean, if we are only consumers, mere consumers, as you say, what does that do to change, say, how we use these technologies and how they interact with our brains?
So your only job as a good consumer is to consume, to choose between the Cheerios and the Cocoa Puffs, the Mercedes and the Ford, the whoever's on sale for political candidates, right? And they're busy getting money in so that they can spend money on advertising to tell you whom to do stuff for. Politicians even used to think of us as citizens. And when you're trying to protect or defend or make life better for citizens, that's a different task than making life better for consumers.
The economy has changed, though, in recent years. And this is something you've explored. Airbnb, Uber, the list goes on and on of businesses that are based on the idea that we're not just consumers, that we can provide things to each other, that we can share with each other, and that this can be a basis for an economy. Is it only possible with technology? Is this an example of where technology is maybe being the solution as opposed to the problem?
There are many ancient ways of being together in community that are based on these relationships. In fact, part of my theory is that we're naively reinventing a lot of ways we used to live together in community on the commons. The technology has taken away the costs of connectivity and has made the entire world visible to us from wherever we sit.
So, of course, there is a cost, though. I mean, you pay for your cell phone, you pay for your internet service provider.
Exactly. But at this point, it's a sunk cost because we've all done that already for some reason or other to get invites to a party so we can ever have a social life again, right? Whatever reason. So that's kind of a sunk cost. So the marginal cost of doing this is near zero. And all of a sudden, it's really easy to form groups. It's really easy to go find, somebody, I've forgotten how to tie a bow tie.
Somebody can help you with that.
Guess what? Do a quick search and you're done. And you'll have 10 videos showing you how to tie a bow tie. In fact, there's probably multiple styles of tying a bow tie.
You've moved on, or not perhaps moved on and left the relationship economy work behind, but you've started a new project that's really exploring trust, how we build institutions that are based on trust and can actually enhance trust. So talk a little bit about that.
Exactly. The relationship economy idea is still all over in my head, and I've realized that in order to focus it, I can focus down on trust. If anybody's ever used the Wikipedia, did you notice that there's a little thing there that says edit? That means that any idiot from the whole planet can come along and edit, the definitive now encyclopedia of the world. What's up with that?
I have to say, I've been on Wikipedia pages and had a moment of like, wait, they would trust me to edit this? I don't know anything about it.
So this is a huge insight because most things that work in the relationship economy are really weirdly counterintuitive. You're like, what do you mean someone's going to borrow my car and go drive off in it? What do you mean I'm going to host strangers in my, all these different things from the sharing economy, from open source software, right? Nobody particularly owns it. And it used to be that software was kind of owned and licensed out, and you couldn't do anything about it. You couldn't affect it or change it or know if it was even good. And now that's all, we're busy reinventing this with hundreds of movements around the world that sound very unrelated. Everything from traffic calming to unschooling to microfinance to the sharing economy, all these things have in common trust. Because somewhere in the last 100 years, we lost faith in the average human. And we turned over all of our institutions to be designed by engineers and managers for efficiency, scale, and profit.
And assuming that the humans were
not really trustworthy.
Not very intelligent and mere consumers.
Mere consumers, precisely. And I believe that we're rediscovering that we're actually humans and that we're pretty clever, that most people are more trustworthy than we think they are, that we're born good and connected to nature, and we socialize a lot of these things out of ourselves with our education system, with a lot of our cultural norms and expectations. We actually get rid of our genius. And it's the rare person who survives into adulthood with their curiosity and genius intact. The system is designed kind of to stamp it out. But I think that we're slowly figuring out how to be in society in this space at the same moment as the space is being taken, coerced, and by all sorts of people with all sorts of motives. And we haven't really figured out even where the training wheels are. Both of these trends are happening at the same time. 200 years from now, when we look back, I'm not exactly sure which of them will have won. But I know that when I wake up in the morning, I know which one I'm fighting for.
Tech analyst Jerry Mikulski. Jerry, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Speaking of trust and online interactions, the Equifax breach has brought the issue of data insecurity into the lives of an unprecedented number of Americans. Fast on the heels of that news, Apple announced that the iPhone X will use facial recognition for security. We'll be digging into both of those stories next week with a critical look at the discrimination built into facial recognition and, on the bright side, efforts to put individuals in the driver's seat when it comes to how businesses use our data. In the meantime, we'd like to hear from you. What do you do to protect your identity and personal data online? Tweet us at Living Lab Radio or find us on Facebook. Until next week, I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.